Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han this morning. It's coming up to 9:37 right now. Time for Ringgit and Cents, the show that's all about personal finance. And I'm delighted to welcome back our regular guest, Rajan Devadasan, the CEO of RD Wealth Creation. He's also a Securities Commission licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad. Welcome back, Rajan.
Hi, Melissa and Han. It's very, very good to be back, especially
good
on this topic.
Good to have
topic.
You on. Yes, the topic today that we're going to be looking at is Warren Buffett's annual letter to his shareholders and the kind of main takeaways from the Oracle of Omaha. So, Rajan, I understand it that you are a huge Warren Buffett fan.
I am. I'm not alone in this. Lots of
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
But it's the same, actually, as with the Big Bang Theory. I started watching Big Bang in the first season, long before most people knew about it. And so I actually heard about Warren Buffett from a friend of mine who at that time was one of my best journalistic sources.
Mm-hmm.
Legendary fund manager, Malaysian Tan Teng Boo. You would all know
yes,
him.
Yes, from iCapital.
Yes. So Mr. Tan was one of my best sources when I was a journalist for Malaysian Business from 1990 to 1994. And sometime in the early 90s, I was sitting down in Mr. Tan's office, and we were actually talking about the brand value of Coca-Cola, and he mentioned this name, and I'm like super blur, and I'm like, who's Warren Buffett? But, you know, that at least introduced me to the name. So I'm always grateful to Mr. Tan Teng Boo for that.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, he recently released Warren Buffett, that is not Tan Teng Boo.
Buffett
recently released his latest letter to the shareholders. And I guess we'll start there. We'll start with some of the key takeaways from that letter. Rajan, do you want to kick it off for us?
Sure, yeah. So Buffett's letter to shareholders is avidly awaited by, I think, probably hundreds of millions of investors around mm-hmm. the world. So like I said, I first got to know the name in the early 90s. But in... let's see, I think January 2nd, 1996, I started work for a magazine in Singapore, which was just starting up, called Smart Investor. And so I'm traveling back and forth, right? And I remember picking up a copy of a book by Roger Lowenstein, which had just come out. It had been published in 1995. And it was entitled Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. And that really cemented the deal for me because I was just blown away by what he'd actually accomplished. Now, in Lowenstein's book, he, at that time, remember, it's like a long time ago, it's 1995, he had an opening paragraph and he talked about how Warren Buffett had built one of the epochal fortunes of all time, something like that. And then it was $9.7 billion and, you know, a lot of money, even now.
Some at that point, yeah.
But
even now, yeah.
A few days ago, I was checking, and Buffett's right now, he's not the richest man in the world. He's the third richest man in the world, or the richest person in the world. And his net worth is $87 billion. So that's a long way to go from 9.7.
Oh, we can only hope.
We can only hope, each of us, yeah. So this letter of his is usually released on a Saturday, so it gives people a chance to digest. And the latest letter came out on Saturday, February 24th. So it basically is a letter to the shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway. Now, Buffett started buying shares of Berkshire sometime in 1962, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he went in simply because it looked like a decent counter that had been beaten down, and he thought he was just going to buy and then maybe make a little bit of money and exit. But he had a broker friend in New York who was able to find various sizable blocks of Berkshire for him. And so Buffett started accumulating. And he accumulated so much that he kind of freaked out the individual controlling. Mm. I can't remember his name, but the surname was Stanton. And Stanton was quite perturbed. And so there was this deal to try and buy out Buffett.
Mm.
And Buffett was quite happy. He was going to make money. But he eventually found out, and this is Lowenstein reporting, and I'm just remembering what I read. Buffett had a price in mind, and he felt that Stanton was actually trying to chisel him. They were, what's it, like 3/8 of a point. I mean, what is that? Less than 50 cents apart in price. But because of the fact that Buffett thought that he wasn't being treated fairly, he dug his heels in.
Mm, on principle.
I guess. And he was not happy.
Right.
And, you know, most of us have a sense of this avuncular figure, right? But Buffett can be very tough.
Right.
He was at one stage the richest man in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, what happened is he continued to accumulate shares. He also continued to accumulate support, including at least one member of the Stanton family. Mm-hmm. And so on May 10th, 1965, Buffett took control of the company.
Right.
Again, relying on Lowenstein's book. The closing price on that day, May 10th, 1965. I know this because I was just short of my first birthday. I was born in May 64, so May 1965. That closing price was $18 a share for Berkshire. Now, the Berkshire A-class shares are $300,000 per share. You're talking about close to 1.2 million ringgit. One share.
Wow.
So thankfully, those who are keen to follow Buffett have a cheaper option, which is something I did some time ago.
Well, hence his valuation as one of the richest people in the world. So now, this is a personal finance show. So for the average retail investor, perhaps the potential investor who's listening to this, you know, can they realistically emulate the kind of wealth creation or rather wealth amassing that Warren Buffett had? Because, you know, the market dynamics in the 1940s and 50s, vastly different from where we are in 2018, right? So does this strategy of just buying a little bit here and then just hopefully gathering that wealth, does that strategy still apply today?
I believe it does.
That slow and steady approach?
Well, you still have to be very nimble. Mm. There are lots of market commentators now who say that buy and hold is long dead. I happen to disagree. I think you actually need to stay nimble for some parts of your portfolio. And there are certain things that you can identify and say, okay, I mean, let's take a view to see whether 20 years from now, or 30 years from now, we think this company is still going to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And is it going to still be dominant? I think on the news just now, there was something about Maybank's results.
Mm-hmm.
I love Maybank. I accumulate Maybank shares. And I think Maybank will be around for a long time. So I don't need to be wading in and out unless, of course, there's a huge shift. But there is something I would like to say about what Buffett put into his letter. Now, there are several quotes that I've actually pulled out, which I don't like wasting anything. So I'm going to leverage off that and I'm going to use this for my own newspaper column on Sunday for the New Sunday Times. But can I read this out to you?
Sure.
It's a specific quote from Buffett from this letter. Our aversion to leverage has dampened our returns over the years. So even Buffett is effectively saying that, yeah, I mean, if you use borrowed money and you get it right, then, you know, you can make more money.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem to bother him. And then he goes on and he's referring to his vice chairman and longtime friend and partner, Charlie Munger. Buffett goes on, but Charlie and I sleep well. Both of us believe it is insane to risk what you have and need in order to obtain what you don't need. And he said this a long time before he was worth... he believed this a long time before he was a billionaire.
Right. So this raises the question of whether there's such a thing as good versus bad debt or liabilities or leveraging, right?
Mm.
Now, how, you know, are there some tips as to how we make that distinction then? Because obviously Buffett says that, you know, he has an aversion to leveraging.
He does, but he must be very specific. He's talking about leverage with regard to the stock market.
Mm. Okay, so now, borrowing money to invest in the stock market.
That's
okay.
Right. He's very specific about that.
Margin financing.
Mm. Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. In the Malaysian context, and again, for full disclosure, a large part of my own income comes from the unit trust portfolios that I manage for my clients. And, you know, for many, many years, there's been this option where clients can actually borrow money if they want to buy more unit trust funds. That has always struck me as being incredibly unwise. And another old friend and a bit of a legend in the Malaysian market, Edmund Chia, who used to be the CEO of KL Mutual, Eddie and I, along with Mr. Wong Bun Choy and a few other people, we've actually ended up co-authoring three books together in 1998, in 2000, and I think in 2008, something like that. Eddie, as CEO of KL Mutual, at a time when heads of other companies were actually trying to encourage people to go out and borrow money, Eddie made a stand and he went on record saying, make sure that you don't get your people to borrow money to go for unit trust margin financing, which is a reason that I still respect him a great deal today.
All right, it's coming up to 9:47, and we're going to get more pearls of wisdom from the Oracle of Omaha, also the Oracle of BFM, if I may call him that, Rajan Devadasan, right here on Ringgit and Sense on The Morning Run, wow. BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good morning. It's 9:48. You're listening to Ringgit and Sense on The Morning Run. This is the show that's all about personal finance, and we're looking at Warren Buffett's annual letter to his shareholders this morning. Some of the key takeaways. On the show with us is Rajan Devadasan, the CEO of RD Wealth Creation. He's also licensed a Securities Commission licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management Services Berhad. Now, if you'd like to join this conversation, our WhatsApp number is 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. So, Rajan, you mentioned earlier that one of Warren Buffett's advice was not to use borrowed money to invest in the stock market.
Specifically.
What are some of the other advice that he mentioned in this letter?
Okay, just from this most recent letter, there's a bit that I thought was very interesting. Let me quote again. Charlie and I never will operate Berkshire in a manner that depends on the kindness of strangers or even that of friends who may be facing liquidity problems of their own. During the 2008-2009 crisis, we liked having treasury bills, loads of treasury bills, that protected us from having to rely on funding sources such as bank lines or commercial paper. We've intentionally constructed Berkshire in a manner that will allow it to comfortably withstand economic discontinuities, including such extremes as extended market closures. This is extreme. It is a very solid position. And, you know, for a business person just starting out, no, you really can't do that.
Right.
I mean, if you can't borrow money from the banks because the banks are tightening, you have to go and check out relatives and friends.
Sure.
But the thing is, you want to make sure that when things go to hell in a handbasket, and we're now in a fresh season of increased volatility, that you don't get hurt because someone needs to make a call on the loan. And so building up liquidity a lot more than people assume you need is quite wise.
Mm.
And Buffett and Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger right now, as far as Berkshire is concerned, as at the 31st of December 2017, were sitting on $116 billion US worth of cash and treasury bills.
Mm.
And they're not happy about this because it's too much money. But Buffett doesn't believe in going out and just buying something because he's got loads of money and then bidding it up. He will only buy if the price is right, which I think is an old TV program. The price is right.
I think it's still going on. So, you know, again, breaking it down to the retail investor then, so is that a necessary prerequisite? Build up those cash buffers, those liquid assets before you start dabbling into the riskier asset classes. Is that the name of the game? I mean, can we afford to do that at the risk of perhaps missing out those returns in the meantime?
Oh, no problems at all. Thank you, Han. Good question. The next investment bus will always come along quite soon. Don't ever fall for the ploy of some so-called investment savant who comes and says, this deal is for today only, and if you miss it, too bad. Then by all means, miss it. Don't let anyone coerce you into putting in more money than you can actually afford. I had an interesting meeting with two of my financial planning clients yesterday, husband and wife. The husband some time ago received some bad news and was actually retrenched. And then I was heartened to hear that subsequently the boss came back and said, maybe we have another role for you. But because I tend to err on the side of caution, I'm just establishing the portfolio for these clients, and I'm actually telling them, look, until we get visibility on your career, let's forget about investments. Let's just build up the cash. Let's build up the bonds. Just raise liquidity. And then once you know that, you know, you've got a proper contract, everything is in good shape, you're going to be earning money, and then I will allow you to ratchet up the risk.
All right, so lesson number one, don't borrow money to invest in stocks. Lesson number two, you know, make sure you have enough of that liquid buffers before you dabble in the other riskier assets. And while speaking about stocks, I think there's another quote here that you are about to highlight about, you know, the volatility in stocks and how to weather that, right?
Great. So let me read that to you. Stocks surge and swoon. Buffett's words, yeah? It's beautiful. So alliterative. Yeah. Stocks surge and swoon, seemingly untethered to any year-to-year build-up in their underlying value. Over time, however, Ben Graham's, and I'll explain this later, Ben Graham's oft-quoted maxim proves true. In the short run, the market is a voting machine. In the long run, however, it becomes a weighing machine. I think this is particularly pertinent because we're moving into GE14.
Mm.
And, you know, if you talk about voting machine, where it's very much supply and demand, lots of buyers, very few sellers, price goes up, lots of sellers, few buyers, price comes down. But ultimately, in the long run, you've got to look at the quality. If it's investments, the quality of a company. If it's in a national arena, it's the quality of leadership. You got to see whether there's real deliverables. So what Buffett is basically saying here is that he is relying on his first and greatest mentor, Benjamin Graham, the father of security analysis. Ben Graham wrote in 1934 a book called Securities Analysis. I always forget whether it's security analysis or securities analysis. People can check it out.
Yeah.
But he also wrote in 1949 or 1950 a book called The Intelligent Investor. Now, Buffett was born on August... You can tell I'm a fan. Buffett was born on August 30th, 1930. Munger was born January 1st, 1924. So now I'm just showing off. But yeah.
That you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you're older than us?
way. But... when it comes to all that he learned about how to invest in the long haul, Buffett, at the age of 19 or 20, picked up Ben Graham's copy of The Intelligent Investor, and he came across a line that changed his approach to investing. The line ran something like this. Investing is most intelligent when it is most business-like.
Mm.
And growing forth from that, both Buffett and Munger have many, many times in their speeches and in their writings, they have said that they don't look upon individual shares as tokens to be flipped in a casino. Mm. They look upon it as fractional bits of ownership of a business. So you've got to ask yourself, look around Malaysia. Malaysia is vibrant. It's an amazing country. We've got so many things going for it. Look around and figure out which companies you think are going to be around in the next 5-10 years. And if you don't have the skill set, then, whether it be unit trusts or ETFs, people have launched things recently, you want something that is aggregated that will give you a level of diversification, but you want to be in the game. And
right.
So, thankfully, you don't need huge amounts of money to get started. But you want to manage and make sure that you don't use borrowed money, which is expensive, to go into the stock market per se, or even to buy unit trust. Take things slowly.
Mm.
Use your own money. And as you begin to manage your salary, your business income, build up buffers. At the very least, have an emergency buffer, EBF, emergency buffer fund, mm-hmm. for general expenses. But if you can, then also set aside separate pools of money for the next vacation you want to take. Taxes are coming up. I just received a letter from the IRB. I guess it's a good problem to have. You got taxes to pay, you're making money. So I've got to find the money to pay the taxes now. I'm not alone here. A lot of people are nodding.
I'm sure a lot of people can relate.
Yeah. Right.
So going back to how we approach these stocks, right? Again, like you mentioned, once we have those buffers and when we set aside those emergency pools of funds, so we look at the fundamentals as opposed to, say, those sexy trades, you know, those guys who just, you know, like you say, flip those tokens, right? So we look at the business and study its fundamentals. So if, again, I'm trying to break it down for the average layman there, you know, what constitutes, you know, a good, solid, you know, fundamentally sound company?
Okay, very good question. May I say that ideally, I would like to invest in companies that actually make money. They actually generate profits.
Okay.
So not Uber.
I mean, I also have a trading portfolio, I'm quite happy to, but that you use your own cash, you don't borrow as far
right,
as that.
Yeah.
And that's a momentum play. But this is for the serious money that, you know, you're going to be sticking with, or you're going to hope is going to fund your life for decades to come. And for that, I would want to look for something that generates profits. I love dividends. Now, Buffett doesn't believe in paying out dividends because his capacity to compound is so much greater than almost anyone else's in the world.
Yeah, I think he only paid dividends like once to
shareholders. And he said he was
ever.
In the bathroom. It was a 10-cent dividend. Yeah. And he said he must have been in the bathroom when he was declared.
It was a blip.
But in general, I like companies that pay dividends. I like funds that are dividend-focused. I hope that helps.
Yeah, okay. So dividend plays and also fundamentally focused. So, you know, with the 1 minute that we have left, Rajendra, so going to give us a summary here. So what is the biggest takeaway from Warren Buffett's letter?
So
then?
Much pressure.
Yeah, no problems at all. Yeah. There's
one
another
minute.
Quote that I think
He's
ties in very well.
He's the oracle of BFM. Yeah, so it's fine.
Wow, thank you for the promotion. Another quote from Buffett. Investing is an activity in which consumption today is foregone in an attempt to allow greater consumption at a later date. Risk is the possibility that this objective won't be attained. One of the core financial planning principles of my practice is delayed gratification. I was deeply gratified to see that Buffett put this in his widely read letter.
Very nice, delayed gratification. And on that note, we have to say thank you to our guest, Rajan Devadasan, the CEO of RD Wealth Creation. He's also a Securities Commission licensed financial planner with Manulife Asset Management Services, Berhad. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han for Ringgit and Cents. Today, we've got the 10 o'clock news bulletin coming up with Sabrina Magdalene. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.